Welcome to The Point. I'm Indy Todd. According to the Center for Disease Control, excessive alcohol use is responsible for 95,000 deaths in the U.S. each year. Since the start of the pandemic, alcohol consumption has been on the rise. People report they are drinking more frequently and earlier in the day than they did pre-pandemic. There has also been an increase in alcohol sales in liquor and grocery stores, and an increase in the number of people seeking treatment or supports for alcohol use disorder. Today, we talk about the impact of the pandemic on alcohol consumption and warning signs that we might be drinking too much. We also discuss the social and economic costs associated with alcohol use and inequities in access to treatment. With us is Kate Lena, Substance Use Prevention Manager for Barnstable County. Hi, Kate.
Hi, good morning, everyone.
Daniel Rodriguez, Associate Director of Substance Use Disorder Services at Duffy Health Center. Hi, Danny.
Good morning, all.
And Nancy Regan, Nurse Practitioner and Director of Substance Use Disorder Treatment Program at the Community Health Center. Hi, Nancy.
Good morning.
So there isn't hard data available at this time to show exactly how much alcohol consumption has increased during the pandemic, but self-reported data and alcohol sales can give us a general sense. Danny, what are you seeing on the ground here on the Cape? Are there more people seeking help with alcohol use?
Mindy, yes, I would say, during the pandemic and up to date, the number of individuals who have been seeking treatment for alcohol use disorder has definitely skyrocketed, at least in the data that we have internally at Duffy Health Center. Just to kind of give a context, fiscal year 19 prior to the pandemic, we had about 50 individuals who were requesting detox. About 60% of those were looking for alcohol use primary, and many of the others had co-occurring disorders. But in fiscal year 20, that jumped up to 196. And in this past fiscal year, the number of detox placements we supported was 367,
wow.
Which really speaks to the sheer number of individuals who are looking for support.
Yeah. Nancy, what about the patients you see at the Community Health Center? Are you seeing an increase as well?
I think we're definitely seeing an increase specifically in alcohol use disorder. And I think what I'm noticing anecdotally is an increase in crisis situations. So yes, they're coming to our facilities to seek assistance and detox and help. But we're seeing a lot of post-emergency room visits where they're going in either a traumatic injury, a fall, gross intoxication, or really just feeling they're at their max during withdrawal and they're seeking help in the emergency rooms. So we're definitely seeing a lot of that.
And Mindy, if it's okay for me to also throw in, Nancy brought up a really good point about emergency room admissions. I hate to be the data guy, but, again, in fiscal year 19, we supported about 101 individuals who were in the emergency room, substance use alcohol related, kind of a co-occurring piece there. And just to jump to fiscal year 21, that number jumped up to about 812. So again, the significance of folks who are accessing acute emergency care, Nancy's right on the money up with that one.
Yeah. Kate, before the pandemic, there was data showing that alcohol use disorder rates in Barnstable County were above the state average. Remind us the scope of the problem before the pandemic hit.
Sure. So yeah, the most recent data we have from the State Department of Public Health is from 2017. So typically data is a little delayed, but I think the pandemic kind of slowed things down even more. But back in 2017, the data was showing that in Barnstable County, individuals seeking treatment, identifying that alcohol was the primary substance that was problematic in their life, was about 47.4% of individuals seeking treatment overall. Statewide, that number looked like 32.8%. So definitely much higher here, on the Cape. And I think it's something that has always been around on Cape Cod, and the pandemic only made it worse.
Yeah. Barnstable County periodically conducts an assessment around substance use. What kind of information are you looking at specifically in those assessments? And is there another one planned for the near future?
Sure. Yeah. So the last assessment that was done was a really complete look at what substance use on Cape Cod looks like. So looking at every substance, possible, looking at some of the costs associated with prevention, harm reduction, treatment and recovery, looking at what does the picture really look like. So that assessment was last completed in 2015. And from the assessment, an action plan was created And that was, you know, looking at the years of 2015 to 2020. So as, you know, we all know, we're in 2021 now. So yes, that is, that's my hope in the role now. I've been in this position for about 2 months, and I think it's time to do another assessment, but making sure to include, you know, data from 2020 and 2021 to really get a picture of what happened during the pandemic.
Yeah. Nancy, we used to think of alcohol abuse as sort of a black and white issue, right? Either you're an alcoholic or you're not. But healthcare providers now look at a spectrum of mild to severe alcohol use and call it a disorder. Can you describe symptoms of a mild disorder versus a moderate and severe disorder?
Certainly. So there's a diagnostic criteria for substance use disorder. There's 11 key points that we look at, and we score it based on how many the individual is endorsing a positive answer to. So, you know, examples: using in larger amounts or for longer than intended, wanting to cut down but being unable to, cravings, spending a lot of time using or recovering from your substance, inability to manage commitments, a lot of social factors, so like problems in your relationships, giving up important activities, continuing to use despite physical consequences, putting yourself in danger, and increasing tolerance, meaning being able to increase more of the substance, and then withdrawal symptoms when you stop using substance. And so a mild addiction might be 2 to 3 of those symptoms versus severe, which might be 6 or more. So we do try to address all these key points as we're providing our assessment.
Danny, is there a helpful way to think about alcohol dependence as we consider where someone falls along the spectrum?
I would say so. You know, we consider oftentimes behaviors associated with alcohol use. You know, depending on you know, what someone's experiencing and kind of how they see their drinking style is really important. You know, one indicator for us as a team at Duffy Health Center is, you know, when we start to have conversations with patients where they're talking about the secrecy of their alcohol use, whether that be, you know, keeping it away from family and loved ones, or, you know, oftentimes when we start getting into conversations about, rather than buying a bottle of alcohol, which is in the household, to, you know, transitioning to purchasing smaller amounts of pints or nips, you know, in certain communities that are still selling them, and, you know, feeling judged by others around them who are concerned about their drinking. That's where, you know, we start to notice marketable differences in, you know, kind of where they are in their continuum from kind of this social behavioral aspect.
Go ahead, Kate.
I think this idea of the spectrum is really, really important to talk about, because I think in the past, the definitions, you know, in the theme of addiction and recovery have been really black and white. And, you know, the assumption that it looks the same for every single person, therefore the treatment should look the same. And I think one of the most important kind of breakthroughs in a way in this field is the idea that alcoholism looks different for every single person. Recovery looks different. The definition is going to be different for me than it is for Danny or Nancy. And understanding that and recognizing it and allowing folks to use their own language to describe what's going on in their own life, I think is really important.
Yeah, excellent point. Yeah. I guess this could be a question for any of you. What are some warning signs that might indicate a person has or could develop a problem with alcohol?
Well, if it's okay, you know, hop in here. I think that the starting point for everyone, all of us, should be really understanding our kind of genetic makeup, family histories, you know, what brings us to the table as human beings. You know, unless we're willing to kind of look at, you know, our familial history and kind of our possible, you know, historic susceptibility to substance use and alcoholism, then, you know, we're starting from a deficit. I think from there, you know, I would also look at, again, you know, speaking from a patterns perspective, you know, what does that look like for, you know, your day to day? You know, are you a daily drinker? Are you a weekend warrior, for lack of a better term? You know, do you find yourself binge drinking during certain time periods? You know, if you go out to have drinks with friends, are you able to have one, or do you find yourself needing to have multiple drinks in you know, one, you know, one visit with your friend group? So, you know, these are the things that folks definitely need to contemplate as they kind of assess whether or not, you know, as Kate said, the drinking is problematic for them, right? Is it really is unique to that person. Someone may say, you know, I'm okay with having a drink every single night. I don't see myself as someone who has an alcohol use issue. While others may say, you know, I find myself drinking a drink every night. You know, this is concerning for me.
Mm-hmm. I think environmental risk factors, sorry to interrupt you.
No, go ahead.
I think environmental risk factors are something to consider. In this context, I think about, you know, my adolescent or my college age primary care patients who aren't coming to me seeking treatment for alcohol use disorder, but they are sharing that, you know, in the college environment, there's a lot of binge drinking. There's a lot of high risk drinking that could have acute consequences. Again, like I said, traumatic falls or intoxication that brings them to the emergency room. So just because they're not drinking every day or drinking more than their peers or whatever, it could still be considered problematic drinking. Doing a risk assessment there is important.
Yeah, that's a really good point, Nancy. I was just thinking, I had a roommate, my first roommate in my 20s, who, you know, she hardly drank at all, very, very rarely. And she decided to go to college after, you know, being out of high school for a couple of years. And she became an alcoholic after college because of exactly that, because of the binge drinking and moving forward. And it was, you know, so surprising, right? But it's, yeah, environment does play a big role. So if you have concerns about a friend or family member's alcohol consumption, what are some ways to proceed? I know it depends on the situation, but what are some options people could consider?
I can jump in first. I mean, I think being willing to, you know, have an honest conversation with the individual, approaching from a place of love and compassion, you know, asking open-ended questions and speaking about the things that you're observing, you know, yourself in that person, and, you know, making sure that you're not including judgment in that conversation, because once there's judgment or demands, then I think the conversation automatically gets shut down. When there's openness and you're coming from a place of love and wanting to support and help, that's when the conversation can really be honest and you can, you know, get somewhere with it.
Go ahead, Nancy.
I just want to add to that I think what I've been most moved by in my work in this field is that guilt and shame is a built-in component of this disorder. And so even with the most caring, compassionate approach, somebody's already feeling that that edge or that, you know, that pang. So I agree with Kate so wholeheartedly that coming from a place of compassion is the best you can do.
Yeah, Danny?
Another piece that, you know, may come into play with this too is, you know, I think the compassion and love component of, you know, having these open conversations is pivotal. But at times, you know, when you have a relationship with someone, regardless of what you hear from them, you know, there's always this sense of, you know, this is someone who's close to you, who, you know, you may or may not value upfront what their opinion is. So having opportunities to speak with other individuals who are non-biased or, you know, are not going to look at, you know, the situation, you know, with any particular blind spots can be really important. And there are a plethora of opportunities, you know, especially here on Cape Cod, where, you know, individuals who have questions about whether or not their, you know, substance use or alcohol use is problematic can reach out to someone who can kind of walk them through and help them assess whether or not they feel as though, you know, it's an issue and what resources are out there. You know, rather than getting to a point of crisis and, you know, where someone needs to go to, you know, acute with detox or, you know, acute level of care, you know, there's opportunities to find those supports at a more local level, you know, prior to, again, this crisis.
Yeah. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join the conversation. 866-999-4626, our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about alcohol use disorder. With us is Kate Lena, Substance Use Prevention Manager for Barnstable County, Daniel Rodriguez, Associate Director of Substance Use Disorder Services at Duffy Health Center, and Nancy Regan, Nurse Practitioner and Director of Substance Use Disorder Treatment at the Community Health Center. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Sheila is giving us a call from Harwich. Hi, Sheila.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
Good. I just had a question, and I'll take the answer off the air. I'm wondering about any programs that people know about on Cape Cod for teenagers. I just jumped on the show about 10 minutes ago, so I know it's a harder population because the kind of rehab places for adults, you know, it doesn't really work as well for kids. And also, there's probably not any. So, it just if anybody knows anything about that, I would really appreciate it.
Great, Sheila. Thank you for that question. I saw three heads nodding as you were asking the question. Who wants to jump in with that?
I would love to. So, yeah, Sheila, thank you so much. And if you couldn't tell, but I was smirking very widely here, behind the screen. To answer that question is yes. CAPE is is unique in a sense that we do have a specific program for adolescents, ages 13 to 17, called our Recovery Build Alternative Peer Group. And it's actually a partnership between Duffy Health Center and Behavioral Health Innovators here, which is designed to, support, adolescents for 6 months with a clinical perspective, as well as a fun social model to help build insight, skills and understanding of their substance use. And the lovely part about this is that actually our Cape region has recently received additional grant funding to expand this program. So as of this previous Monday, this alternative peer group is being facilitated at Pleasant Bay Community Boating in the Harwich area on Tuesdays and Thursdays from 5 to 7, and in the Falmouth area on Mondays and Wednesdays, same time from 5 to 7. If family members, loved ones, or individuals do have questions or would like to learn more about this as a resource, folks can reach out to, the intake team at Duffy Health Center. And I am blanking the number off the top of my head, but if you do look in Google, just the alternative peer group on Cape Cod, there is more information on a direct contact with our program supervisor, who is Jeremy Wurzburg. And to speak a little bit more broadly, I would say, substance use, access to substance use for adolescents is really challenging in Massachusetts. There has been in the past few years, a couple of inpatient programs that have closed down, for families here on Cape Cod. If someone does need an acute care inpatient, you are going far off Cape to access that. The only positive that is coming down the pike is that, we were recently told at an RSAC meeting that our colleagues over at Gosnold are going to be opening up at their Katamit site a co-occurring disorders program that is going to be able to serve adolescents 16 plus, who are struggling with mental health and substance use. There's light at the end of the tunnel. Let's say this, it may not be as much as we need to serve this population, but we definitely see some things coming down as we move forward.
Mm-hmm. Kate?
Yeah, and there are two really great statewide hotline resources that folks can call. And the people that run the hotlines are really knowledgeable about all of the different resources in the state, broken down by age or substance of use. So you can call 211. That's kind of the simplest number. You can also look up the BSAS Substance Use Helpline. And both of them, you can just call with questions. You can call looking for, a bed for someone in that moment. But the folks that run them are just really great. I recommend reaching out to either of those.
We talked earlier about risk factors, and research has shown that people who start using drugs and alcohol at an early age are more likely to have substance use issues as adults. And this statistic just blows my mind. I have to repeat it every time I have an opportunity, but I'm sure you know Dr. Ruth Pote, who's in the western part of the state, and she was on the show one time and stated this, that if a person does not do drugs or alcohol until their age was 25-ish, you know, once the brain is fully developed, they have a less than 1% chance of becoming an addict. That to me is mind-blowing. So if you can get your kid to that 25, you know, that age, they have such a much better chance. And of course, the younger you are, the higher the risk, right? So I guess, Kate, what kinds of substance or alcohol use educational campaigns are targeted at that adolescent demographic, and have those campaigns been sidelined because of the pandemic?
Yeah, that's a really great point. And prevention is a really important topic that I think did get sidelined to a point during the pandemic, because schools were not in session at all at times, and were not in session in person at times. So it's a lot harder to assess what's going on with a kid or a young adult if, you know, you're sitting across in a Zoom call like we are right now. But there are a lot of campaigns individually within the school districts themselves, as well as most of the town coalitions that exist, also have prevention campaigns going on. Just this Monday, so a few days from now, the Barnstable School District is holding their annual prevention forum. And that's taking place, I think it's at the Barnstable Adult Community Center at 6:00. And there are a lineup of speakers, as well as a program called In Plain Sight, where you know, parents are able to tour kind of a mock bedroom to look for what kind of signs they might need to find or hope to not find in their kids' bedrooms. So I think there's a lot of programs like that educate parents. There are programs within the school systems that are educating the students. I think we need to focus more on it, but I think there is a good amount going on.
Yeah. We might not even realize how our consumption of alcohol is impacting us until there's a reason to stop drinking. So Nancy, can you talk about what happens in the body when someone who regularly consumes alcohol stops suddenly?
Yes. Thank you for bringing that up. I think this is an important topic, and I can't tell you how many people I come across who've had a significant withdrawal period that they didn't know was going to happen. There's a lot of folks who drink regularly who don't realize how dangerous it is to stop abruptly. And so, yeah, alcohol withdrawal goes through a period of about a week. In that first 8 hours, if you're drinking consistently and you stop drinking abruptly, you will start to feel some symptoms. You'll start to feel some anxiety, maybe some insomnia, maybe some sweating, nausea, vomiting. As the days progress, you could, without knowing it, be experiencing high blood pressures, increased body temperatures. If it is still left untreated, stage three, toward the end of the 1 week period, it could progress into a potentially lethal syndrome called delirium tremens, commonly abbreviated as DTs, which would be notable for hallucinations, fever, seizures, agitation. So, you know, I come across a lot of folks who come to me after a hospitalization for even something else, and they don't, either for shame and guilt reasons or because they don't realize it's relevant, they don't let the healthcare providers know that they've been drinking consistently. And so they're, in addition to whatever illnesses are occurring in the hospital, unbeknownst to everybody, there's also this alcohol withdrawal syndrome that can land you in the ICU or worse. So I think it's really important to really get this information out there that stopping alcohol use abruptly, if you are using that consistently, can be really dangerous. Yeah. Mention in terms of recognizing severity that you mentioned. We talk a lot in primary care about how much are you drinking in terms of like how many drinks per day, but you really want to think about size of drink, how big is your glass of wine? And for men, the goal would be fewer than 14 drinks per week and no more than 5 per occasion, and women 7 drinks per week and no more than 4 per occasion. And I can tell you probably half my primary care panel has on occasion exceeded that amount. So yeah, thinking about how much you're drinking, how consistently you're drinking, and then again, understanding you should never stop abruptly.
Right. So Danny, what are some options for helping someone detox safely?
So, you know, I think the primary option, which is going to be the safest and is recommended, is to go to, you know, acute care facility, so a detoxification program. You know, as Nancy stated, doing doing it without medical supervision is very high risk. It does take a team of very well-versed professionals to be able to ensure that someone is not going to go into DTs or experience another medical issue related to withdrawal. And as part of these programs, there is also an opportunity for individuals to learn a little bit more about, you know, their problematic drinking behaviors or what resources are in the community. And the other access point that I would say would be, you know, if someone is experiencing symptoms or really are struggling with, with anything related to, you know, discontinuation of alcohol, you know, hospital settings typically are able to support them in a short-term way with the hope of linking them to, you know, the right program moving forward.
Mm-hmm. And how common is the need for medical care during detox? I mean, what are the options? Is it, do you just go to the ER and then they refer you to something else? I mean, how, go ahead, Nancy.
It's a loaded question, I think, particularly in the setting of the pandemic, right? So the ERs were overwhelmed. The ER staff is potentially limited. So yes, ideally, you present to the emergency room. They can provide A, monitoring, which is probably the most important, B, medications to try to mitigate the risk and manage these symptoms. You know, it's a lot to ask of the emergency rooms because we're currently facing a bed crisis. We have limited staff in detoxes. We have limited bed availability. We have too many patients and not enough resources. So I think that's a loaded question. Yes, my short answer is certainly you are having difficulties or you are feeling like you're at risk for dangerous withdrawal. An emergency room is a great place to go. But I do think it's important to look at the systemic issues that we're facing right now.
Yeah, I'm just wondering too, like, you know, if you're saying the ERs could be overwhelmed, there might not be beds at a detox facility. So are people getting sent home with any kind of supports? Danny, you're raising your hand. Go ahead, Danny. You want to answer that?
Well, I want to add to what Nancy shared, but I'll answer that question first. Mindy, you know, that is that's the million-dollar question. Let me put it that way. In a lot of ways, you know, it is a very high risk for, you know, an emergency room setting to send individuals out with medications that would help to support, someone through the withdrawal. You know, typically it's a benzodiazepine or some other type of medication that can be abusable. And oftentimes, if, again, someone is not well-versed in medication management and is experiencing the symptoms of withdrawal, there's an opportunity to to inappropriately use the medication as not prescribed. And that's not fault of their own. It's just a matter of, you know, trying to figure out independently as a non-medical person how you medicate for these symptoms. The other thing too is, unlike mental health inpatient units, where typically you need to be assessed by an agency prior to an admission to a psych facility, substance use treatment, they do accept individuals, you know, straight from the community. So, you know, there is also an opportunity to empower individuals who are having concerns to either independently reach out to programs, you know, to see if there are available spots for, you know, to go in to, you know, go through a withdrawal protocol. And the other thing too, you know, we talk about how community agencies can be anchor points for individuals to go directly to them to talk about, you know, these concerns. So I know that for Nancy and for our team at Duffy, you know, folks can come directly to us and say, listen, I'm concerned about my drinking. I really feel as though I'm at a point in time where I need to do something more. Our team will hit the ground. Our teams will hit the ground running and relentlessly support them with trying to get them into a bed and making sure that all of the barriers are broken down to see them successfully enter that level of care. Because it can be very trying.
Yeah. So, Danny, since the start of the pandemic, what's been your experience then trying to find detox or treatment facilities for your patients?
So I would say in early COVID, there definitely was an availability of beds just because, you know, folks were concerned and scared about what it meant to be in kind of congregate settings, during early COVID. But what we have seen recently is actually really problematic. A lot of the facilities that are taking, individuals for acute withdrawal are closing down a lot of their beds. And it is due to the fact that there may not be enough staffing. You know, there may be a concern of COVID on the unit itself. You know, there are so many factors. Employment, you know, concerns around employment has really affected every, you know, level of our society at this point. So I know that at one point recently, our regional director shared with us that just in the Southeast region, I think that there was 60 beds that were down, which, you know, that indicates how challenging it will be for folks to get into treatment. And anecdotally, I would say, you know, historically, my team at Duffy, if someone came in and said, listen, I would love to get into a, you know, acute care setting today, we would be able to, in that day, get them to a treatment facility. In the last 2.5 weeks or so, we've had individuals that we've been calling daily for about 4 to 5 days until we can actually get them into a treatment program. So where the work comes in at that point is, how do we, you know, have a stopgap measure that will support someone through until they're able to get into an acute treatment? And sadly, oftentimes that is just continue your alcohol use, because again, there are no medicating outside of a treatment facility is very high risk, but we need to make sure that you're not going to go into DTs or have, you know, negative consequence of, you know, just discontinuing your drinking. So, you know, you have professionals who are saying, don't stop drinking until we can help you stop drinking. So, you know, that is our current climate.
Yeah. I just have a question about the insurance status. I mean, does your health insurance status play a role here? And, you know, do they take mass health patients? I mean, how does that impact all of this? Go ahead, Nancy.
I can probably speak a little bit to that, and I'm sure the others can as well. You know, I think it does impact. I think there's always an equity issue here, and there always has been, that there are certain facilities that won't take MassHealth because the reimbursement is not as high. So if you have MassHealth, you just don't qualify for some of these places. And I honestly feel like those places have better bed availability because there's fewer people with those private insurances that they're accepting. So yeah, I think it's a glaring inequity. Danny has a comment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I will add to that. Yeah, insurance, as Nancy said, definitely plays a role into it. You know, just for contextual purposes, for someone who is uninsured, there is one place in Massachusetts that you can get care, and that's in Worcester. And if that program does not have beds, wait in line, you know, until something kind of shows up. And it's not just access to care, which is problematic, it's duration of care and what is on the outside, or what's the next step post acute withdrawal. You know, for folks who are able to access, you know, private insurance, oftentimes their ability to move on to, let's say, you know, a residential program or something more that's not just a, you know, 5 to 10 day alcohol withdrawal protocol, it's there. You have an option. You have somewhere you can go. If you have MassHealth or, you know, you're uninsured, oftentimes, you know, your opportunities to extend your recovery pathway in treatment facilities is either heavily reduced, or there just is nothing and you're returning to the community. So, you know, that's what we also, when we talk about inequities, you know, we really need to focus in on not just insurance, but, you know, cultural competence of these programs. You know, do they have programming for non-English speaking individuals? You know, are they able to serve, you know, individuals that are coming from multicultural backgrounds? And, you know, just to speak at a greater level, we know that our community members of color tend to be less successful in treatment programs, not because of who they are as individuals, but because our programs are not uniquely designed to serve, you know, kind of more culturally competent, from a more culturally competent framework. You know, they are designed to serve historically kind of individuals who identify as white, typically males. So, you know, we definitely have a long way to go in assessing how we treat our community members.
We are talking about alcohol use disorder. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about alcohol use disorder. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. With us is Kate Lena, Substance Use Prevention Manager for Barnstable County, Daniel Rodriguez, Associate Director of Substance Use Disorder Services at Duffy Health Center, and Nancy Regan, Nurse Practitioner and Director of Substance Use Disorder Treatment Program at the Community Health Center. So when we hear about detox, many might assume this only happens to people who have very serious addiction to alcohol, but that's not necessarily the case. Nancy, what are some of the other factors that can contribute to how a person experiences detox with alcohol?
I think the one most recent case that I'm thinking of is, first of all, certainly potentially age. Your overall health could contribute. I recently had a case where an individual went into severe withdrawal pretty quickly. It turned south pretty quickly, and come to find out she'd also been prescribed benzodiazepines. So I think if you're prescribed benzodiazepines plus alcohol, it's going to compound or increase your risk for having acute withdrawal and severe withdrawal. So I think a lot of coexisting medical factors are at play. Again, something that the public might not be aware of, but just making sure that not putting the onus on the patients, but I think all of us should be doing a good substance use screening as we take people into care, right? I think in the hospitals, there's so much to think of, and we may not always think of that, but substance use is so common in our society. It should be one of our screening questions for sure.
All right, Kate?
Yeah, I think that's a really important point, and making sure that when we're talking to folks about substance use, when we're talking about alcohol use, we can't ignore the idea that people use other substances. So making sure that polysubstance use is primarily part of that conversation, just in case there's anything else that they may have on board. So not ignoring the topic of opioid overdose and carrying Narcan, just in case they might be using, something else at the same time.
Danny?
Mindy, you brought up an important point as well. We have been talking about the continuum, the spectrum of alcohol use disorder. If someone is chronically drinking, but the amounts are, lower than someone who is, having higher problematic drinking, there still are going to be symptoms of withdrawal, just on a much lower level. Oftentimes if someone, is a consistent drinker and kind of discontinues for a day or two, they may notice, increased irritability. Sometimes they may just not feel kind of well. It's not, major symptoms, but just not feeling kind of comfortable in your own body. There are impacts of, alcohol use in general, especially when it's on a longitudinal level rather than kind of the occasional drinking.
There are links between stress, anxiety, depression, and substance use disorder. Are you seeing a rise in the number of people who are presenting with both behavioral health issues and substance use disorders since the start of the pandemic? Everybody's nodding their head. Yeah. Go ahead, Nancy. Go ahead.
I used to joke when this first started that I quickly went from being a primary care provider to a psychiatrist, because the majority of my daily interactions with patients were really anxiety-based. I feel like it kind of took us through the scope, right? The initial was anxiety-based because everybody was fearful of their health. I think we then swung into the depressive phase because we were all socially isolated, bored. I think all of this contributed to increased drinking. I think that they go hand in hand. Sometimes it's always a question of, did anxiety and depression come first and then the drinking, or vice versa? I think sometimes the lifestyle can lead to anxiety and depression. Just on this topic, veering off a little bit, talking about anxiety, depression, coexisting disorders and risk factors, we should mention history of trauma as a significant risk factor for substance use disorder. So a number of studies show that adverse childhood events or childhood trauma can really increase this. So if you're starting out with a history of trauma, add to it some substance use disorder and then a global pandemic, it's quite a perfect storm that I think we've been seeing.
Yeah. Kate?
Yeah, and I think this is another area where we really need to focus on adolescents, because while the adult behavioral health world is really difficult to maneuver, I think what's available for children, youth, adolescents, young adults is even less available. And what we've been hearing is that students and youth have been affected, just as much, if not more so, because of the pandemic. And right now, as we're starting to kind of re-enter community and society and seeing folks again, what providers on the ground are telling us is that they're seeing students asking for more help. And so we need more social workers and therapists and counselors who focus on, you know, working with adolescents and also thinking about what unique things might come up as we're coming out of this pandemic. You know, is social anxiety something that we're going to see more often than maybe we have in the past?
Go ahead, Danny.
To kind of bridge on both what Nancy and Kate said, you know, we at Duffy Health Center, we have a community partnership with the towns of Yarmouth and the town of Dennis, where we provide a recovery support navigator, you know, part-time to be able to field, you know, community requests for substance use support. So, you know, that's free to anyone within those communities. In our statistics over time in the past few years, we've noticed that about 97% of the folks that we've served have a co-occurring mental health disorder or diagnosis. So, you know, Nancy kind of put it very eloquently, you know, did the mental health come before the substance use, or did the substance use come before the mental health, right? That's the million-dollar question. And as Kate was saying, you know, focusing in on early intervention, especially with our, you know, adolescent and young adult population is really important. And it's not, for me, it's not just focusing in on, you know, how do we have these conversations about, you know, early on substance use, but what are the coping skills that folks can use? Because as Nancy said, you know, adverse childhood experiences and trauma is a major part of a risk factor for substance use. So, you know, we also are lucky on Cape Cod to have pretty innovative community resources to help build insight and support for our adolescents who are looking for, you know, strategies to reduce their anxiety or depression. You know, one program that comes to mind is Calmer Choices, which teaches a lot of meditative practices. You know, they've been doing a lot of really hard work in school systems. So, you know, the opportunities are there. It's just a matter of, you know, being able to link to those opportunities.
Mm-hmm. Nancy, go ahead.
Just on the topic of trauma, there's one more population that I don't want to forget that I'm now seeing in this next wave of this experience, and that's healthcare providers. A lot of my work in addiction, I'm now seeing the traumatic fallout from folks who were on the front lines, who are emotionally exhausted, who feared bringing illness home to their families, witnessed acute tragedy on the daily in their positions, and I'm seeing a lot of alcohol use and substance use as a fallout from that. So those are the people in mind now too.
Alcohol use disorder has both a social and an economic cost, and it's a cost that's shouldered by everyone in the community. You can't help but look at the police logs and see the number of calls that involve alcohol. And there's a ripple effect of alcohol use disorder on families, lost productivity at work, etc. Danny, how do you think about the costs associated with alcohol use disorder, and how do you think it should inform how we move forward as a community to address this issue?
That's a really good question, Mindy. And, you know, something that always revolves around my mind and, you know, my team talks about it a lot is historically communities in general, and I would say Cape Cod, you know, the question is, how do we respond, you know, to folks who are struggling with substance use? How do we have resources? How do we kind of, you know, move forward? When I think that what we need to start asking is, how do we create our, how do we make ourselves a recovery community? Right? How do we feel comfortable across all aspects of our lives, you know, employment status, schools, primary care, you know, friendship groups? How do we, you know, take away the stigma of substance use and actually feel comfortable having conversations and being able to be prepared and knowledgeable to know what's out there, what exists, and how we can, you know, support someone else with connecting? So, you know, when I think of costs of substance use, and specifically alcohol uses, folks will go a very long time of, you know, not, you know, sharing that they have a struggle with a substance use or alcohol use because they're worried about getting fired. They're worried about, you know, what that will mean for themselves or their families, or, you know, all of a sudden someone from the Department of Children and Families kind of being alerted to these problems, which is devastating to the, you know, the timeline of what happens for these individuals. So what I think is really important is for us to start to teach our communities of how do we have these conversations. You know, I would say as a business person, it's probably, it's going to cost you more to lose an employee than to support your employee. And, you know, especially nowadays where, you know, staffing and finding eligible employees is it's challenging. We need to be prepared to have these conversations, have a solution, and have an outcome, a return, have a way in which folks can say, listen, something's going on with me. I need to take an opportunity. You know, if I broke my leg today, I'm going to go to the ER. My employer is going to be like, great, I'll see you when you come back. You know, folks who are struggling with substance use don't have that comfort. So, you know, that's kind of my viewpoint and lens when I think about that.
How about you, Nancy?
I couldn't agree more with what Danny said. I think that any criminal fallout or any police action or any domestic violence or whatever else occurs while people are under the influence is a symptom of untreated alcohol use disorder. And so I think if we focus more on treatment than criminalization, I think it's more cost effective, as Danny said, and it's just going to be a better outcome for our society here.
Mm-hmm. Kate?
Yeah, so as you were asking that question, I was looking at that baseline assessment and looking at, you know, what is substance use spending look like on in Barnstable County? And from 2013, the total amount spent, direct cost of substance abuse in Barnstable County was $110 million. So that's a lot of money.
That was 2013, right? 2013, you said.
2013, yeah. So, and I'd like to redo this, you know, in with the upcoming assessment. But I think more importantly, if you break it down and look at, you know, where's that money actually going, or where is it being spent? $700,000 is going towards harm reduction. About $1 million goes towards prevention. $57 million goes towards law enforcement, and just under $52 million goes towards treatment and recovery. So, I mean, I think, you know, looking, I think we see anecdotally and just, you know, where people struggle to find support, we see that, you know, we hear that from people, but looking at, you know, this breakdown of the costs, I think, you know, prevention has only $1 million of that $110 million, $100 million. So just looking at where is the county spending money, and maybe where should we be spending money?
Yeah, just about a minute and a half left. Anybody have a final thought that we'd like to leave listeners with?
I'll just throw in, you know, I can't stress enough how important it is for folks who are, you know, challenged by a substance use disorder or are questioning whether or not their substance is problematic for them to ask for help. I know that we hear that a lot. I know that it's easier said than done. But, you know, walking this road alone is incredibly challenging, if not impossible. It takes a community to support one another around, you know, these really troubling situations. So if nothing else, not to sound cheesy here, but please, you know, if you have any questions, comments, concerns, don't feel shy reaching out, you know, talking to someone that you trust, whether that be a loved one, family member, or if you don't feel comfortable, reach out to a community partner such as ourselves, you know, the folks on this call. You know, we're there, we're ready, and, you know, in a non-judgmental way, we're prepared to, you know, support you with figuring it all out. So thank you.
And we'll post links with more information about support services and treatment for alcohol use disorder at our website, capeandislands.org. Daniel Rodriguez, Nancy Regan, Kate Lena, thank you so much. And thanks so much for the work that you do.
Thank you, Mindy.
Thank you, Mindy.
Thank you, Mindy.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.